year's edition of Job, what I hope will be year two of two on this book, but can we make no promises. There are several people who told me that that they are going to be here, but they're not going to be here this week. So what that means is if you want a seat at the table, you're going to have to make sure to be here on time. Please make sure, in general, that you have at least a book of Job, if not a Tanakh. In the cabinet back there on the left, they have, I believe, some of the green Tanakhs, the art scroll ones, then they're available for use. I am Mordechai Turchiner, and we are now, as I said, a year into the study of Job. So what does that mean for somebody who wants to join in as we're up to chapter 20? Well, first of all, we're going to do a review today, and it will be a review, I hope, somewhat clearly of the major themes. We've seen a little bit of it chapter by chapter just to get a sense of the flow of the book, and hopefully that will put people in a good stead. And frankly, each week when we refer to ideas that have been referred to before, we'll talk about where they showed up before and how they developed. It isn't as though, even for those who have been here from the beginning, and frankly even for me, it's not as though you remember everything from chapter 1 when you hit chapter 20 anyway. If you have the sheet, which I understand Rebecca is making more copies of, you'll see at the top I posted two links. One is a link for the audio recordings of the classes. The other is a link for video recordings of the classes. The audio ones also have the handouts. Sorry? Oh, no, the videos have been posted all the whole time. I don't know what the issue would have been. I don't know whether it works on mobile. It's not my website, so I couldn't tell you, but maybe that would have been an issue. You watched me in Europe?
Yeah, I was in Europe.
Well, then I did make it to Europe. How do you like that? Okay.
Did you have fun?
Oh, it was great. Where were we?
I can't say where I was because everybody here is Jewish
and I'll hate it. Oh, boy. Okay. In any case, the link will be a little hard to retype probably from the printed copy, but I also sent it out to the email list last week, and I will be glad, of course, to send it to the email list once again. I just need to know that you're on the email list. If you didn't receive it, that probably means you aren't on the email list yet. So Rebecca is going to give me the information from the sign-in sheet, and then I'll be able to add people to the list for the class. Okay. So we begin with a basic discussion of the book itself. A year ago, we had a little bit of this discussion as well. The question of why is it that Job is such a fascinating book? And one reason it's fascinating is because of the part that people actually read before they get bored. And that's the beginning. The opening two chapters, conversation between God and the Satan, in which what sounds like a gamble is set up. Let's see what happens with Job. Let's see if it's possible to push him too far, so to speak. And that's something that certainly fascinates people. But more, it's because the book asks one of the most fundamental religious questions, right? The question of theodicy. Why is it that which God seems to promise within the Torah, that good deeds get rewarded and that bad deeds get punished, why doesn't that seem to carry through in reality? Now, Job is not unique in asking this question in Jewish scripture, in Tanakh. The book of Jonah asks the question, the book of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes asks the question, the book of Habakkuk asks the question. But Job is unique in terms of the length of time it devotes to spelling out and discussing the question and the variety of answers it suggests / rejects for it. Frankly, the answer ultimately given to Job doesn't seem to fit the question, which is a point we'll have to explore when we get to those later chapters of the book. It also asks another question that we're going to have to spend a lot of time on, which is the question of what motivates people to act virtuously. Why do people do good things? So in other words, it's not just a question about God's behavior, it's a question about our behavior. What motivates people? Is it win prizes? Is it you have an internal compass that's telling you? Is it loyalty to God? What is it that motivates people to do right? That is also a major question of the book. So why doesn't everybody learn it? If this is why the book is fascinating, why doesn't everybody learn the book? Well, for starters, we spent last year finding out that the language... Well, the book is a downer. All right, Ralph's answer first. It's a depressing book. It's a difficult book. The language is extremely challenging, both the vocabulary and the sentence structure. The speakers are wordy. Their messages and their metaphors are not entirely clear. The connection between the message of one speaker and then that of the next is not entirely clear within the book. The commentaries tend to be interested in promoting particular angles on it rather than simply explaining what's going on. And that's hard, and it's a long book. It's 42 chapters. That's an awful lot of reading. So, you know, for all these reasons, people don't get around to it, but it's a shame because there's an awful lot here that we can learn from. The basic structure of the book, I outlined it for you on the sheet for those who now have a copy of it. It starts out with the dialogue I mentioned between God and the Satan. We'll come back to that in a moment, but I just want to give you the overall outline. In chapter 3, Job begins to suffer. In general, on the sheet, I write Job instead of writing Eov, but I see that I wrote Eov sometimes. So bear with me on that. I apologize. Nothing more confusing than writing it all in the Hebrew than writing part of it in the Hebrew and part of it in the English. We strive to confuse. The chapter 3, we get Job's suffering and his initial response in which he curses the day he was born. More on that later. And then we get three rounds of debates in which Job has three visitors, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And each of them has something to say, and Job has something to respond to each of them. And they go one go-round of speeches, and then a second go-round of speeches. And then finally the third go-round, in which you only get some of the speakers. Eliphaz speaks, Job responds, Bildad speaks, Job responds, and then that's the end of the third round. Job then restates his case. Then you get this brand new speaker named Elihu, who we didn't see at all last year. Finally, God addresses Job. Job responds, and there's an epilogue. That's your basic structure for the book. The styles in the book are, on the one hand, you have this prose story in the beginning, and then this very poetic set of speeches in the middle that make it sound like it's two different texts. But on the other hand, there's such consistency between them, both in terms of theme and in terms of form, despite the prose poetry difference, that it does seem like they're all telling one story and they belong as one entity. And that's certainly the way that it was canonized within Tanakh, within Jewish scripture. A little bit about the origin of the book of Job. And by the way, this is the longest, for those who are new to this, this is the longest you will hear me monologue all year. Normally, this is discussion. I'm just trying to get a lot of information out. But if there are questions as I'm describing things, please interrupt me and ask. The classic question that was asked last year was the question of whether this story of Job is unique to us or does it show up elsewhere in the ancient Near East? And the answer is yes and yes and no and no. The story itself has stories that resemble it or passages that resemble it, in which you will find passages about apparently righteous people suffering, then complaining to their gods, and then being restored. At the same time, the pieces don't really match because they tend to show that you're rewarded for when you turn to God. And with Job, we don't find him turning to God to be rewarded. It doesn't work that way. Job's presentation here within Tanakh really does stand out as something unique and different. Having said that, the commentator Ibn Ezra believes, as he wrote on chapter 2, sentence 11, that the book of Job, as it appears in our Tanakh, is not the original. It was originally written in some other language, he doesn't specify what, and translated from there into Hebrew. Which then leads to the question of, so who wrote this originally? Is it Jewish or is it something that was brought into Judaism? And it's not clear. He just has this one cryptic comment and he doesn't explain what he's talking about. That's it. Chapter 2, sentence 11, look up Ibn Ezra. He doesn't say. But one thing that we do see here that I think is important is that various sections of the Torah present lessons to the Jewish people in terms of responses to the ideas of others, responses to the ideas of the Egyptians among whom the Jews had lived, responses to the ideologies and theologies of the Canaanites, and so on. It's possible that we are meant to see within Eov, within Job, a response to ideas on suffering seen elsewhere. So that there are these other texts that are showing up in the ancient Near East that are presenting ideas, and Job is our sage's response of, well, this is what we believe in return. It is canonized by the Great Assembly. It makes it into Tanakh. Unclear exactly when it was written down, but likely towards the end of the first Beit HaMikdash, the first temple period, or sometime between the two temples, are likely. And we talked about all the reasons to date it at different times last year. We also saw many debates between Jewish sources, Talmudic and later, as to whether Job ever lived. Was Job a person, or is Job meant to be a parable? Just, you know, meant to teach us a lesson. Okay. What are we supposed to think as we read this book? First of all, when is the story supposed to be happening? We don't get a time frame. There is no reference within the story itself that will link it to a particular event in Jewish history or human history and make us say it occurred at that time. The Talmud has a debate using a very interesting technique of essentially literary criticism, historical, taking words that show up and saying, well, this word can be traced to this time in history, and therefore the story occurs at that time in history. But there's nothing conclusive there. Maimonides, Rambam, actually sees the confusion in the Talmud as evidence that the whole thing is just a parable. The fact that you don't have a clear moment in time and a clear conclusion indicates, yeah, because it didn't actually happen. It's a story that's being told to teach a lesson. Is Job Jewish? Is Job Jewish? The answer is, don't know. On the one hand, he is meant to be a protagonist of a story in Tanakh. And so we sort of assume that makes him Jewish. Generally, the heroes in Tanakh are. Also, you see the way that his suffering can mirror the suffering of the Jewish people towards the end of the First Temple, through the period in between the Beit HaMikdash, in between the temples. On the other hand, there are serious elements within the story that indicate that he's not meant to be Jewish at all. One being the reference in the book of Yechezkel, the book of Ezekiel, to three righteous people who are residents of wicked towns. And one of them is a man named Noach. One of them is a man named Daniel, not to be confused with Daniel. And the other one is Job. Is Noach Jewish? No, Noach is not Jewish. Daniel was also this ancient Near Eastern figure. He's also not Jewish. And so putting him there in this list makes it sound like he's not intended to be a Jew. Couple that with the fact that the language in the story is so exotic with, you know, elements of other Semitic languages, it's entirely possible that he's not intended to be Jewish at all. There's more to be said on it again, but I'm just condensing in the interest of trying to give an overview. Some of the major questions that we need to think about as we read the book, the obvious one is, what does this story do for theodicy? Looking at a story in which somebody is suffering without having done anything wrong, and that's made very clear in the book, even though the Talmud does have a discussion, as we've seen, of what might have been his sins beforehand, the general consensus is that he's right when he says, I have not sinned. So how is it that he comes to suffer? That's obviously a question we have to think about. Another question is the question that I mentioned earlier of, why do people do good things? Why are people righteous? Does Judaism believe in the right to revolt, as Job does? Even as he maintains that his revolt is actually loyalty to God, he claims that he is a loyal revolutionary. Does Judaism endorse that? Is Job a good man who is driven over the brink, or is he a bad person who masked it well when things were good? How do I look at him? Remember, we noted last year that the name Eov in the Hebrew, if you transpose two letters, becomes Oyev, meaning What is an oyev? An enemy. Right. So these are all questions we need to ask ourselves as we read. One thing I would love to spend time on, but there's just no time to do it, and we did spend it last year, is just an overall discussion about reward and punishment in Jewish thought. Meaning, even outside of Job, and outside of Habakkuk, and outside of Jonah, and outside of Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, the truth is that the entire biblical text is conflicted. Meaning that you find sections in the Torah that indicate clearly that individuals and nations will be rewarded and punished in kind with their actions. And on the other hand, we find texts that show very clearly that it's not so. That there are people who commit evil who will thrive, and there will be righteous people who will suffer. So that's a broader discussion, which, you know, maybe at some point this year we'll come back to some of the elements, but again... Right now, I just want to do an overview of the book, and I'm already 15 minutes in, and we haven't actually touched it. So, now we'll see the overview of the chapter by chapter of the first 19 chapters, at any rate. We're good so far? Okay. So, chapter 1 is the start of the saga. And we begin with, I'm not going to be reading verses aloud now, but we begin with an introduction, and we find that Job is wealthy. Job is devoted to God. He is concerned about sin, including even sin in one's own mind. He is concerned that his children might have had thoughts of blasphemy against God, and he therefore brings them to bring sacrifices to God as a way to atone for even thinking something that's inappropriate about God. The Satan, this very odd being, attacks. He comes to God and he says, you know, there are no righteous people anywhere. No one is righteous. There is nobody out there who actually worships you, who is sincere. And God says, that can't be. Look, there's Job. At least there's Job. Now, what in the world are we supposed to make of the idea of this being who turns to God and says, people are terrible, people are not sincere in their service of God? So Maimonides, again, emphasizes his belief that this is a parable. There is no actual conversation like this going on within the universe. But remember that the word Satan itself refers to an obstructor, someone who tries to block, someone who tries to cause trouble. And in many sources, as we've seen, Judaism looks at the Satan as an entity God has designated to find fault in human beings. And we noted that within the text itself, in chapter 1, there's a description of a gathering of malachim, of beings that serve God, angelic beings, and Satan is not, so to speak, an invited guest. He's not part of the group. There are those who serve God directly. Satan's service has something very ignominious about it. You don't get to be in God's inner circle. But he shows up anyway, he crashes the party, because he wants to make a statement about human beings, that human beings are not worthy. That's his declaration to God. And God says, I'm going to let you test Job in order to demonstrate that you're wrong, that human beings can be sincere, and that human beings can be worthy. And so Job ends up as a victim of what is meant to be the justification of human beings. This is a showdown that's not about Job at all. It's a showdown that's about, can human beings be worthy? And poor Job is going to be on the chopping block as the one who's going to be the subject of the test. His life is destroyed in four steps in the middle of chapter 1. It's the day when we had said that all of Job's children invite each other to feasts each day of the week. This is the beginning of the week. The firstborn is going to bring all of his family together for a celebration. It's right after they have brought offerings to God, atoning for any sins that they have performed, so therefore they should be entirely innocent. And news arrives of attacks from all directions, from human beings as well as from nature. And his children are killed. The wealth is all gone, taken captive. Everything is destroyed. And Job ends the chapter by responding to the test by grieving, but accepting God's actions. He says, God has the right to do whatever he does. God gave it to me, and God took it away. I own nothing. We don't get his perspective on how his children would feel about that. In other words, it's one thing for Job to say, they were given to me and they were taken away from me. They might think a little bit differently. Nonetheless, Job's response is, God has the right to do whatever God does. And that's his conclusion at the end of the first chapter. So, this could have been a very short book, right? God goes back to the Satan and says, see, Job's a good man. In fact, what God does is he accuses the accuser. He says, Job is loyal, human beings can be wonderful, and you failed, Satan. But Satan doubles down and says, you kept me from hurting Job personally. Let me hit him personally, and then let's see how he responds. When it's not somebody else's death or somebody else's pain, but it's actually something inflicted on him physically. And so he strikes Job physically. And then we get a new element to the story, and this is chapter 2, sentence 8, and that is the introduction of Job's wife. Job's wife doesn't really get much in the book. She gets 6 words in 42 chapters, which tells us, as we discussed back when we did chapter 2, that she's not a person in this story. What she is in this story is a plot device. She is present in order to do something to Eov, in order to do something to Job. And what she does is she says to him, you are still claiming to be Tam. You are simple. You are one with God. That's what you believe about yourself. That's the stance you're taking. She says, blaspheme against God and die. That's her statement to him. And then she disappears for the rest of the story. We don't know what happened to her. We don't know. Alive, dead, walked away, nothing. But she's what she really is in this is a further test of Job. And from here, the tests leave the realm of the physical and become instead psychological and emotional. Instead of a test of you have boils on your skin and they're painful, now it's a test of your own wife is telling you it's time to reject God. And Job rejects her goading. He said, look, human beings have to accept what God does. He doesn't say it's God's right. But he says human beings have to accept the things that God does. And that's already a change in his position. And at that point, his 3 visitors arrive. I always have trouble with this. We talked about this last year. The fact that we call them his friends, and they don't sound like it. They think they are, but it's awfully hard to use the word friend for them. But they're his visitors at any rate. There are 3 visitors, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Eliphaz is listed first. He is the one who will speak the longest. He seems to be the one who is most senior among them. And then you have Bildad, and then Zophar. I'll talk about them a little bit as we get to their speeches. But the commentators tend to see in their presentations statements of philosophy that are meant to be debated in the book. Their statements are so stylized that they don't sound like speeches that one would deliver in a Sheva house, so to speak. They don't sound like one human being talking to another human being. They sound like what you would write if you're writing a chapter in a book. So that feeds into the idea that, again, this is meant to be a parable. That doesn't mean it can't have been a historical event. It's entirely possible that there was such a debate, but that when they actually wrote it into Tanakh, they recorded it in a way that would be more poetic. You could read it that way legitimately. But what is clear is that Job's tests are not over. It's not that Job's tests ended with the boils or even with his wife's speech to him, but rather the tests continue. The friends, the visitors, are part of his test, pushing him still further in his views on God and his service of God. In the beginning, they're silent. The first 7 days, they say nothing. And the Talmud actually learns a lesson from there, that when one visits a house of mourning, one is supposed to be silent before spoken to. The idea of just being there to share in the grief. When the mourner is ready to speak, the mourner will initiate a conversation. They get that from this action of the visitors. Job doesn't seem to have the same view. He does not like their silence at all. And that brings us to chapter 3, when after 7 days of their silence, Job opens up his mouth and he curses the day he was born. How would you read somebody cursing the day he was born? What would that mean to you?
None of this happened. If I wasn't born, none of this would have happened.
Right. So one way to look at it is that it is a statement about his suffering. Simply that, it's because I was born that I had to suffer in this way. Good. What else could you read it as? Harking back to last November, so, you know. It's a long way back to remember. Yeah. Well, that's right. It's part of his suffering and wish he could roll back his birth, yeah?
It's also complaining to God.
Yeah.
He would assume that God enables his mother to have him, so he's cursing his mother and God in the process.
Right. All those who were the catalysts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ralph. This is not the way creation is supposed to work out.
Because of the day he was born? Why that specifically?
Because in his mind, God had another plan.
So in other words, it's not the day I was born as much as it is that which was supposed to happen after my birth.
Everything is with a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And this shouldn't happen.
Right. Okay. This could be as well. Another approach is that it's, and this is Ralbag's approach, that Job is actually not complaining about what we think he's complaining about. There are two sort of tracks that run through the book in terms of what it is that Job thinks is happening. One track says that Job believes that God is acting unjustly, that God zaps people and he gives people things, and that there's no justice to it. That's one track in general in his complaints. But the other track is that Job actually believes that God has outsourced the running of the universe. It's an astrological idea, that God has just left it up to the stars to do as they will, and that the injustice is not about each particular event. It's one global injustice. How dare you turn this over to the stars and make everything automatic? And according to that read, the astrology read, everything that's going to happen in my lifetime is dictated by the moment I was born. I was born under the influence of this planet. Everything was juxtaposed in a certain way, and that's what dictated everything. And so what he's doing is he's cursing the day he was born. He's cursing the idea that he is subject to a fate that was dictated at the moment that he was born. Oh, that's what you were saying? Okay, I didn't realize. Okay, thank you. There are other ideas as well. There's more we could say about it. But he curses the day he was born. He curses the night of his conception. And one key thing here, one key theme which shows up especially in round 2, is that he blames his friends, not for his suffering, but he blames them for being distant. When they show up and they sit silently, one could read that as speechless commiseration. But Job doesn't see it that way. Job believes they're holding themselves at a remove. They don't really sympathize with him. And that only becomes worse in ensuing chapters when they actually criticize him. You're like, what, you show up here, you showed up in my hospital room just to tell me I shouldn't have been riding a motorcycle? Like, that's what I needed. There's a lack of empathy in the way they conduct themselves, and he seizes on that, and it antagonizes him to the point where he declares he would prefer death. He would have been better off had he not been born. That, going back to that read of this curse of the day he was born, and he says, I don't understand why God leaves people alive when they are suffering. Susan?
I want to ask, but I can't remember.
Okay.
How does this, Job's feeling of everything being predestined, fit in with our concept of free will?
Mm-hmm. Right, so,
like by this time, in the time this was written, we already developed the concept of free will?
Oh, free will is
right,
biblical. Right. No, free will is a biblical concept. But what according to Ralbag, who is the major, not the only, but certainly the major voice who says that Job is arguing for astrology, he thinks Job is wrong. In other words, he thinks that this book is meant to tell me that the universe is not run on automatic, and that there is
chance.
You know, not just chance, but that there's give and take. You do X, and it will cause this result. You do Y, it'll cause that result, and it's not predetermined.
We see it as chance.
Certain elements, not universally, but certain elements. Yeah.
About these three visitors.
Yes.
Is it in any way clear that they were his friends? He knew them from before. If we take the Shiva setting, were they the only ones who came?
Right.
Were they the only ones who stuck around? Weren't there other people who behaved more normally?
Right. These are good questions. So it is clear they know him from before because they make reference to their history together. So, for example, Eliphaz, in his opening speech, says to Job, you know, I remember when you used to comfort people who were suffering and you were strong then. So he knows him from before. There's a prior relationship. The question of who else is in the room is a really good one. We do know that Elihu is going to be present. You know, and later when he's going to say, well, I waited to speak for so that they would all speak first. So at least one other person is in the room. We also get a reference in a few chapters in which, I think it's Sophar, who says that, you know, I would not speak, I can't really, you know, win in this dialogue with you, except that you're going to lead other people astray, which makes it sound like there is an audience. And these three are just the ones with the hubris to actually debate with him. But there are other people who are present and who are hearing what's going on. That would seem, you know, and yeah, that would seem to fit. Rita.
I just have a quick question. First, he says everything comes from God and he accepts it. And then he says everything is destined by the stars. So isn't that a contradiction?
Right. So the question is, and this goes back to the overall question about Job, is he somebody who has been the Oyev, the enemy of God all along, and he just hid it because things were good, and therefore he felt, let me do what I'm told to do and see how long my run goes? And that's one way to take it, in which case he always believed in the astrology. The other way to look at it is that catastrophe has driven him to this. Until now, he thought, you do good things, you get good things. Now he finds that bad things happen to him, and he says, well, it must be that there's no such thing as reward and punishment. Things just happen.
So what does he really believe?
We only get what's in front of us in the book. So that's chapter 3. Yes, Stephen.
Is he laying the foundation for Baruch Dayan HaEmet?
Oh, I think that he's not only laying the foundation, I think he did it. He just moved away from it afterwards. Meaning, you know, what Stephen asks is that there's a Mishnah in Brachot which tells us that one is required to bless God for the bad, even as one blesses God for the good. And that the form that it takes is the blessing that's traditionally recited when tearing after the loss of a relative. When people say, blessed is either the true judge or the judge of truth. But that's exactly what he did in his initial response. You know, when he said, I just have to look at it, at the end of chapter 1, he said, Hashem Natan Hashem Lakach Yishem Hashem Avarach. God has given, God has taken, his name should be blessed. That's another verse that's traditionally recited at that time, you know, at a funeral. So yes, absolutely, he is not only laying the groundwork for it, he's saying it. So in chapter 5, Eliphaz gives his first speech, kicking off round 1. And the major themes of this first round of speeches are the question of whether people are rewarded and punished in sync with their actions. Is there a possibility of a happy ending if Job will approach God? In other words, let's say Job says, I suffer like this and I'm still loyal to God and I'm going to go out and do the things that I've always done, bring sacrifices and so on. Will he get a happy ending? And who has the true understanding of how God works? Is it Job? Or is it these three visitors? So Eliphaz speaks first. And he seems to be the greatest of the three. He speaks first. He speaks the longest. He gets the most real estate out of the three visitors. He speaks with a lot of poetic style. He talks about presenting a prophetic vision. He is a believer in divine justice. He believes that doing good deeds doesn't mean that you've never sinned. And therefore, you could be someone who's done a lot of good and still deserve punishment. But he evolves in his presentation. In his first speech, he emphasizes the idea that, Job, you're a good person. You just need to turn to God. By his second speech, he's more indignant at Job. And by his third speech, he says, we know you've sinned, Job. Stop playing games. It's not clear whether he evolves like this because he loses his subtlety over time, or whether it's because Job is saying things that just so antagonize him that they trigger a change in the way he looks at Job. Interestingly, the Talmud itself uses Eliphaz as an example of what's called Ona'at Devarim. Ona'at Devarim is a biblical prohibition against verbal abuse. And when the Talmud wants to give an example of verbal abuse, it quotes Eliphaz with his address to Job, which is very, very important, because sometimes people approach this text thinking, okay, Job is the rebel against God, and his visitors are the traditionalists, and they're the ones who will be praised while Job will be rebuked. But anything but. The Talmud is actually very harsh in its treatment of the visitors. So Eliphaz's response to Job essentially is the following. First of all, he says, suffering happens for a reason. He opens up by being very apologetic. He requests permission to speak. But then he says, you know, wicked people suffer and they deserve it. You can't possibly be more righteous than God, he says. And in my prophetic vision, I have seen it. Man is feeble and frail and not more righteous than God. And therefore, he says, this is what I'm going to suggest. I'm going to give you a narrative of hope. Outrage is self-defeating, so don't get outraged about your suffering. God is benevolent and just, and God is very worth approaching. So you should approach God, pray, and then God will protect you. That's what Eliphaz says. Things can be wonderful, as Eliphaz's sales pitch. You must have done something wrong. Turn to God, and all will be good. You're a great man, Job. Job doesn't like it so much. He takes the next two chapters, chapters 6 and 7, to respond. And we see in Job here, for the first time, anger. With each round, every time Job speaks, there's something new that he has been goaded into by his visitors. And this time it is anger, which goes in two directions. Obviously, anger against Eliphaz. He says, you know, you're not helping. But also anger against God. He says, you want to know why I'm outraged? I'm outraged because God is shooting arrows at me. I am suffering. I am in great pain. I've lost everything. And as far as you, my friends, you have betrayed me. So he says, you know, I don't know why God would do this to me. I'm just a frail human being. I'm here today, gone tomorrow. Just leave me alone. You don't like me, God. So ignore me. But don't do this. He uses something that we talked about a few times last year, a method which Carol Newsom called linguistic sabotage, in which he takes language which we'd normally associate with prayer and praise of God, like found in Tehillim in Psalms, and turns it into criticism of God. He talks about God is so wonderful and mighty, and he uses language that you'll see in Tehillim and Psalms, but then he turns it into language of rebellion, saying, God, you're so wonderful and you're so mighty and powerful, and why are you turning it against me, huh? He's very sharp. And he says, I wish God would leave me alone, or I wish God would take control instead of leaving things to the stars. But he still holds back. He hasn't yet mentioned God by name as the villain. And he has not yet quite said, God, you are unjust. He just says that, you know, harming me doesn't increase your honor, God, and I'm not worthy of your attention such that you should be hurting me. But he hasn't yet used the magic words, God is unjust. So, up steps Bildad with chapter 8. Bildad is the second speaker. Bildad is very direct, and he speaks very briefly. And his approach is different from that of Eliphaz. Eliphaz believes that everything is just, everything is good. If you were punished, it's because you did something wrong. If you're rewarded, it's because you did something good. Bildad says things may be more complex than that. Sometimes a person might suffer in order to get something better in the future. Sometimes suffering is the price you pay in order to get to a good place. He's also very harsh, in the sense that he suggests, if you can believe it, that Job's children must have sinned. If they died, it must be that they did something wrong, which you wonder, like, really? How in the world can you say that? Like, but that's what he does, or he seems to do. He also evolves in his presentation, in that the first time he says, what looks bad will ultimately prove to be good. And then he, from there, starts to emphasize more that if people are suffering, they probably are wicked. He says the wicked do suffer. Human beings can't challenge divine justice. So he begins his first round speech with a protest defending divine justice and offering a narrative that could end well. He says, when you say that God should just leave you alone, you know, you are essentially saying God is unjust, and that is impossible. When you call out to God, God will help you. And then he offers two parables of plants. He begins by talking about a thirsty reed. And he says a reed that doesn't have a source of water will dry out. What's the message of that parable? When you say to Job, a reed that has no source of water is going to dry out. What is he saying? Sorry?
He's questioning the source of water.
Well, he's questioning the source of water, but what should be his source of water?
God.
If you don't have God as your source, then you know what's going to happen. The same thing that happens to a reed that doesn't have a source of water. His second parable is of a lush plant. And it's a tree that is uprooted and then is planted elsewhere. There are a couple of ways to read this parable. I'm picking one. But he says, Sometimes something terrible may seem to have happened, but it's actually good. The tree was in an area where its roots were confined and it couldn't really get water. But then it got uprooted and planted somewhere else, and then it did wonderfully. So it thought it was suffering, but in fact, things were really good. So Job, you know, you may think things are bad, but maybe there's actually something wonderful going on. So he argues. Needless to say, that doesn't work either. And so Job responds in chapters 9 and 10. And here, the new element for Job is the lawsuit. I highlighted on the sheet, I put it in bold, the new elements that show up in each of Job's speeches. Because I think that's important. You know, I said in the beginning, one of the reasons why people don't learn this is because it's so hard to find structure. And it just seems like a mess. But there really is structure to it. So what you see here is that Job has been pushed into a lawsuit. He will address God here for the first time and say, I want my day in court with God. I demand justice. And much of his language is that kind of language. It's legal language. Yes?
What makes it seem so unstructured... In my opinion, would be the fact that it seems that the visitors would have an agenda, whereas an agenda is not warranted at all. Mm-hmm. They are not there to achieve something. They shouldn't be there to achieve something. Nevertheless, the way this discussion evolves would only seem warranted if there is a agenda to be achieved.
Well, they think they have an agenda. You know, their agenda is to get Job to turn to God, to repent of whatever wrongdoing.
Why would they have that agenda?
Well, it depends how we look at it, right? One possibility is the story is a parable, and therefore they're there to have an agenda. That's why. You know, it's a plot device. You need somebody to be the one who's going to tell Job to return to God. So that's what they're there to do. Sorry? His friends. The other way to look at it is that they honestly believe that you know, this is for his own good. And even though that's so difficult for us to accept, you know, I go back to Newsom again, because I think she's 100% right. You can't read the visitors as caricatures and people who are just senseless and foolish and have no merit and no worth. Because if you do, the book really should be a lot shorter. There would be no need to spend chapter after chapter outlining what they're saying if it was that empty. They're there. They're canonized in Tanakh because there is merit to what they have to say, even if they're going to be rejected. And even if sometimes they're being quoted only to reject them. You know, I mean, the Talmud saying that Eliphaz is guilty of onad dvarim, of verbal abuse, I think is a major lesson that we're learning in terms of what you're supposed to do and not supposed to do. When Job is going to turn to them in round two and say, I could use a little empathy, guys, there's something for us to learn from that. Having said that, though, I think that it's also true that their philosophical points may be misapplied and may be inappropriate for the venue. But as ideas, the idea that a bad thing may appear bad, or an event may appear bad and turn out later to be good, that's a sound logical point, if not one that you want to say to Job. So, you know, I think that we have to analyze what they're saying also, and see messages there too. So, Job's response to Bildad is to say, look, God is mighty, way mightier than any of us, and so there's no winning a debate with him. He's not going to acknowledge I'm right. He's not subject to my authority if I declare myself correct. And so he actually spends time describing divine might as a way to attack God. It's more of that linguistic sabotage. He says, I can't win because God's not going to listen. He strikes me, so I can't even speak. So there's no point. The world is run wickedly. There can be no happy ending. But you know, if God would give me the chance, this is what I would say. And here he picks up on what Eliphaz had said. Eliphaz said, you know, just turn to God. Approach God. Then you can have a happy ending. So he says to him, you want me to approach God? If I were to approach God, this is what I would say. I would say, what is wrong with you that you're attacking me in this way? Why did you create me if this is what you were going to do to me? That's what I have to say. That's my prayer, so to speak, is what he says, and that's why he ends his response to Bildad, which leads to Sophar. Sophar is the third and lowest of the speakers in terms of status. He's direct, he is simple. His focus is on approaching God and God being righteous, but he does add a key element, which is very popular. People talk about this all the time without knowing this from Sophar, which is the idea that you can't understand God. You can't figure out why things happen. You don't see what it is that God sees. And he offers a very interesting approach to the problem of theodicy, a unique way to gauge righteousness, which we'll see right here. He begins with a protest. He says, and this I mentioned before, he says, I have to speak up because there are all these people here who are going to be led astray by the things you're saying. So it sounds like there is an audience, although that's not the only way to read his words. But that's what he seems to be saying in chapter 11. He says, God's wisdom is great and it's hidden. Don't expect God to respond to you. He has this beautiful description of the length and breadth of divine wisdom. Absolutely magnificent. And he says something that is new. He says, you know, human beings don't realize how much potential they fail to fulfill. And he says that's why they suffer. He says, a wicked person may thrive and you think that's unjust. But the reason he's thriving is because he has the potential to be far more wicked and he holds himself back. And then on the flip side, a person who does good things may suffer and you think that's unjust. But it may be because they had the potential to be so much greater and they squandered it. And that's why they're being punished. It's about potential. What he has done is he has introduced an X factor which we can never ever assess. Right? What he's done is he's made his assertion, he has safeguarded his assertion from being falsified. You can never say he's wrong. When he says God is just, and you say, well, if he's just, why did that happen? His answer is because you don't know what their potential was. And he, you know, walks home smiling. That's what Sophar has accomplished with this assertion. But it's a very interesting idea. He prescribes, as the others do, repent and approach God, and then things will be good for you. You'll lose all your turmoil, you'll lose all your agony, and it'll be great. Job responds to the entire first round in chapters 12 to 14. He says, I am, and this is really a key element here. This is what's new here. He says, I am actually the righteous one. I'm the good guy. And he also elaborates in his charges against God here. He says, first of all, you're not enlightening me. You're just mocking me, speaking as though I was some kind of a fool. God is indeed the mightiest, he says, and God is the source of all destruction. And there is no hope. There's no constructive purpose. It's not having a happy ending. And God's going to punish my visitors for misrepresenting him, because they're the ones who lack faith. I'm telling it like it is. I'm describing what it is that God is doing. What you're doing is, you believe in some idolatrous concept of God. You believe in some form of God that isn't real and that doesn't correspond to reality, and you are changing reality, describing it as it isn't, in order to support your vision of God. Well, that makes you idolatrous. As for me, I'm turning to God based on what I see in the world around me. I am speaking the truth, and in this my faith is evident, he says. And we have the classic line that we spent a long time trying to understand, Hein yiktaleini lo ayachel, which either means, though he kills me, I will still long for him, or though he kills me, will I not still long for him? But his statement is, I'm loyal to God. My rebellion is an act of loyalty. So he says, and then he turns to address God for the trial, and he says, here's my case against you. Number one, I am not a sinner. I haven't done anything wrong. Number two, I am insignificant, and therefore I'm unworthy of your attention to my sins. If I've done anything wrong, it's beneath you. And number three, I'm only temporary and lowly, so really, you shouldn't zap me. And he concludes with a point that is philosophically difficult in a book in Tanakh. He concludes by saying there's no hope of resurrection, and therefore there's no hope at all. He says a tree gets cut down, and then new growth comes out of the trunk. Right? I have this wisteria I've been trying to get rid of. That's the perfect example. The tree gets cut down, things just keep on coming out. A human being, he says, human being dies, there's nothing afterwards. So he alleges. It's the ultimate response to Eliphaz's call for a narrative of hope. Right? Eliphaz says there's hope. He says, no, there is no hope. That's it. Now, that doesn't negate the classic Jewish idea anchored in Tanakh of life after death, of Tchiyat HaMeitim, and so on and so forth. It doesn't negate that. It's Job speaking. And just like Job may be offering astrology, which isn't one of ours, he may well be offering an approach that says, nope, there's nothing after this world, and it doesn't make that one of ours either. But that's the assertion at the end of chapter 14. Which brings us to chapter 15. I hope that this outline is useful for things. I hope that it's not just, too confusing because of all the information. It brings back memories. Okay. In chapter 15, Eliphaz kicks off round two, and the major theme of round two, the theme of round one was, God is good, just come back to God and you'll have a happy ending. The theme of round two is, wicked people suffer for their deeds, and that's why you're suffering. That's what they want to tell him. Why is it valuable to address the fate of the wicked? Could be as a warning to Job, or it could be as a corollary. In other words, wicked people are punished, and also, therefore, goodness is rewarded. We spend some time discussing the question of whether they really believe that wickedness is punished, or whether this is a statement of faith. Right? We spent quite a while on that one. But Eliphaz, in chapter 15, says, you're wrong, Job. You can't possibly think yourself justified. And in contrast to his first speech, in which Eliphaz was apologetic, feeling a need to justify even opening his mouth, here, Eliphaz is harsh from the very beginning. He says, Job, you're robbing humanity of their power to be righteous by claiming that God is responsible for evil. No one's going to want to be righteous. I'm sorry, not that. That's not his claim. His claim is that God is manipulating everything, and that if somebody is righteous, it's because God makes it so. And by saying that, you're robbing people of the incentive to be righteous. They'll just say, well, God made me however I am, and this is who I am. And if God wants me to be good, He'll make me be good. He says, the wicked suffer emotionally. They're always in turmoil. I've seen it myself, Eliphaz says. And the wicked have no future. They will not escape punishment. And at this point, Job introduces a new element in his responses. I've already referenced it a couple of times. In chapter 16 and 17, he says two things that are new. Number one, he says, empathy. What I really need from you, Eliphaz, is not for you to tell me I'm a bad guy. Not to tell me to come close to God. What I need from you is to stop being opposite me, where it's you there and me here. I need you to be on my side. That's number one. And number two, he depicts God as enemy for the first time. Not just God allowing bad things to happen, but God as enemy. He rejects the words of his visitors as foolish and uncomprehending. He says, if I were in your shoes, if this were happening to you, and I was visiting you, I would offer companionship. I think he said, "Achbircha b'milim." I would join myself to you with words. God has crushed me, he says, on multiple levels. He has rallied others against me. I am innocent. I demand justice from God. My suffering is great, and I have no hope. Which brings us to chapter 18, Bildad's second speech, in which Bildad offers rebuke, which may be to Job or actually to his friends. He says, God will not leave the land because you don't like divine justice. And he says, wicked people suffer and are ensnared, losing their home, their family, their skin, as you did, which leads to the last chapter we covered, chapter 19, in which Job responds with an elaborate plea for empathy and companionship. He says, you're making me miserable. I am surrounded and crushed. I am alone without any aid. Help me by recording my words. Be my posterity. And then he concludes with what seems to be an expression of faith that God will take his side. Ultimately, God is going to side with me because he knows I am right. That's chapters 1 to 19. What I hope to do this year is chapters 20 through 42. That would be, you know, that's our goal. Remember, we spent a few weeks last year doing the introduction. So, you know, it's possible that we could actually do this. It will be much slower than today. And as I said before, as I said 45 minutes ago, this is really a discussion and not a monologue. So, you know, this was just in order to get information in. The audio and video will be online. Please make sure that Rebecca has your email address. She will send it to me, and that way I will be able to send you the sheet with the links for finding the audio and video recordings. There was one other thing I was going to say, just that, yes, as we did today, we used the entire hour. That's in general what we try to do. So if you can make sure, please, to be here at 1:30, that will be great. Thank you very much.